And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. And we're also available on iTunes and SoundClick. You can find us at the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War webpage, www.hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca. And as I said before the break, we have an exciting interview coming up, and that has to do with Syria. It has to do with coverage of Syria, especially by human rights organizations. And we should have on the line Rick Sterling, a founding member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Rick, do we have you?
Yes, I'm here, Brendan.
That's great. You're coming in loud and clear. And yeah, Rick's been very prolific recently. He's written articles on Counterpunch and a number of other publications this month, last month, March 2014. He's been covering media coverage of Syria, what's happening in the conflict. And recently he's written a piece about Amnesty International, and it's called Eight Problems with Amnesty's Report on Aleppo, Syria. It has to do with, of course, the way that human rights organizations in particular are looking at Syria right now. Now, Rick, I know that there's a lot of media discussion. It's intensifying on Syria, and we've seen this kind of pattern before. And the way that some groups like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch have been looking at Syria is disconcerting in the way that you've been highlighting. I guess I wanted to start today by looking perhaps even briefly at Human Rights Watch. There was an incident earlier this month that was quite interesting. Ken Roth, I believe he's the president or CEO of Human Rights Watch, he had posted on social media a photograph. And that photograph, he said, you know, here's the reality of Assad's barrel bombs in Aleppo. He had a photograph which he said was purported to be of the damage caused by the barrel bombs. But it's my understanding that that photograph was not accurate and it was not a representation of Syria. Can you tell us about that Twitter or that social media post?
Yes. Basically, the photograph was taken in Gaza, and it was a result of the Israeli bombing of Gaza. It had nothing to do with Syria. And it's interesting to contrast how lightly Human Rights Watch criticizes Israel in comparison with the very loud accusations and that they levy against Syria. But the photograph that Ken Roth posted was a photograph from Gaza. Somebody did a little bit of research and pointed it out to him that the photograph was from Gaza, not from Syria, and he said, "I stand corrected." Then subsequently, not leaving it at that, he dug around and he found another photograph of a city in of a destruction in an urban area in Syria, and he posted that and said, "Well, I made a mistake the last time around. The photograph was from Gaza, not from Syria, but here's one showing the result of barrel bombs in Syria." And some people researched that further, and it turned out the destruction was from an urban area that's actually under government control, so that the destruction shown in the photograph was caused by mortar bombing, by car bombs, and by other attacks by the opposition forces.
Yeah,
even there he was inaccurate.
There's a lot to say. The whole exchange on Twitter was amusing and intriguing. I thought that, you know, here you have Ken Roth, the head of Human Rights Watch, this large institution, and saying, "Here's Assad's barrel bombs in Aleppo," and he wanted to show devastation, right? He wanted to show something horrible had happened, so he had a photograph that he thought was that. But of course, ironically, it was the devastation of Gaza by a prime U.S. ally, Israel, which gets a pretty light treatment by the U.S. government and a lot of U.S.-based human rights organizations. So, you know, here's something that was selected as a credible photograph of destruction, but it was destruction wrought by a U.S. ally against the Palestinians. So he was corrected on that, as you point out. So he found what he said was another photo. And yeah, you mentioned it seemed to be of a pro-government area. I think some of the news coverage of that area around that time said there had been fighting between the government and opposition. So that damage shown in the photograph could have been of anything. But I guess the heart of the issue for me is that Human Rights Watch seems to have decided in advance that Assad is monstrous dictator. The Syrian government is guilty of all sorts of atrocities. They're mass murderers. And so if you want to highlight that on social media, you don't really need to dig around or find proper evidence of that. You know, there's been a verdict presented in advance and the evidence is being modified or procured to fit that verdict. You had written more extensively about Amnesty International recently, and I think it highlights the sort of general problems that we're seeing or the kind of pattern in the way that U.S. and Britain-based organizations are looking at this conflict. Amnesty International, for you, had about eight areas that you thought required mention or highlighting. And so in your article, you discuss these as eight problems. And the first one, and I thought this is a very important one, regards external interference. So you said that Amnesty International ignores the external interference that is driving the conflict. So in your view, what constitutes this external interference?
Well, basically, it's not even hidden anymore. It's out in the public domain that a whole array of countries, including Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, France, the UK, the USA, and others, Canada as well, are dedicated to toppling the government in Damascus. So I think it's a gross failing of Amnesty and any other human rights organization, as well as the United Nations, that they are not calling out this violation of the second article of the United Nations Charter, which explicitly says all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. So this is a clear violation of that. I began the article, and I hope some people can read the article. I'd recommend they read it for themselves and evaluate, and they can find it very easily just by Googling my name, Rick Sterling, and eight problems. We'll probably get you there. I began it by referencing what happened back in 1990. Which was in the run-up to the first U.S. attack on Iraq. When Iraq went into Kuwait, they claim with the assent of the U.S. government, but there was the United States was trying to build up support for their case there. They were having trouble. Now, many of the listeners will not, if you're going to university now, you won't remember this, but it was a very big deal at the time in 1990. And what happened was that a huge media spectacle began where it was alleged that Iraqi soldiers were going into hospitals in Kuwait and removing babies from incubators and shipping the incubators back to Iraq. This was a sensational claim. It resulted in a testimony of a young Kuwaiti woman who claimed she was a nurse volunteer in Kuwait and that she had witnessed it herself. The story was corroborated by Amnesty International, which did an interview with a doctor from the Iraqi or from the Kuwaiti Red Crescent Society, and they determined that the story was true. Subsequently, it turned out that the whole thing was a fraud cooked up by a Washington PR firm. The supposed nurse was actually the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, who incredibly had never even been to Kuwait, and that the supposed doctor who convinced Amnesty International that the story was true was on the payroll of the Kuwaiti government in exile, and So the whole story was a fabrication, and it was just it took a long time before the story came out, long after it had any the discovery of the truth of it had any significance, because the U.S. promptly invaded, killed tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers, and that was the launch. That was the beginning of a concerted attack that resulted in probably millions of Iraqi deaths, because it was followed by the sanctions on Iraq, where they were prevented from getting all sorts of staple necessities of life for the next decade, leading up to the 2003, second invasion of Iraq by the U.S. But I guess my point is simply there's we need to look at these reports objectively, and we need to look and see, well, where's the, show me the evidence. Just saying it so doesn't make it so. And Amnesty can make mistakes just like they did in 1990. We see the disaster that's befallen Libya now. We can see what's transpiring in Syria as well. And if there's time later on, Brendan, I want to bring listeners up to date with the latest breaking news today from Palmyra. And a report that's just been released by a Freedom of Information Act. Some information I'll bring up later on, but.
Sure, we should get to that shortly. I'm glad you mentioned Libya as well. Quite a number of organizations seeing themselves as do-gooder types spread all sorts of rumors, including ones that Gaddafi was handing out Viagra to Libyan soldiers so that they could conduct mass rapes. Now, some organizations came out later with a mea culpa saying, oh, well, that wasn't actually true. And that was just one of several rumors that were spread around to gain support for the war. And of course, that is often how these kind of rumors function, whether it be Iraq in 1990 or Iraq in 2003 or Libya in 2011 or Syria in the last few years. And certainly there have been quite a lot of real whoppers about Syria. Now, you said we need to look at evidence and we need to look objectively at how information is being gathered. In your article, you had some complaints or criticisms of how Amnesty gathers its information. I think those are pretty much points 3 and 4. You were talking about how Amnesty relies on witnesses that are biased or possibly paid and coached. Similarly, there's sources like one of them was an ISIS sympathizing source, it appeared. So how is Amnesty getting information about what's happening inside Syria?
Well, they're basically getting it from groups that are all funded by the U.S., by Turkey, by Qatar or Saudi Arabia. Basically, they're getting from quote-unquote human rights or quote-unquote welfare, social welfare groups that are in the pay of governments that are bent on the destruction of the Syrian government. So it's fairly obvious that they might be biased. Each and every one of them, actually, is Amnesty International listed is either paid by the U.S. or is based in Turkey. So the witnesses, the so-called witnesses they gather are suspect. I made the point that if you want to do, an objective evaluation, you have to look around. You can't just take testimonies from one side. And two-thirds of the displaced persons in Syria live inside Syria. They live in other parts of Aleppo. Aleppo was the biggest city in Syria. The conflict areas people have fled from, some of them have gone across the border to Turkey, which is nearby. It's only 25 miles away. As others are in other regions of Syria, so it would have been a reasonable thing to arrange interviews or by Skype or by phone or through a third party with a variety of people, but instead Amnesty only took all of their witnesses from that were presented to them by one side, which is bent, like the governments are, on the overthrow of the Damascus government.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a number of other points in your articles that could be discussed, focusing on some of the specific claims that are brought about Syria. But you had mentioned that you had some breaking news regarding the conflict itself. What is it that you wanted to discuss?
Well, there's two things, Brendan, that are very disturbing. One is that one of the architectural treasures of the world, it's the UNESCO heritage site called Palmyra in eastern Syria, is at risk of being totally taken over by ISIS forces. This is as of today. This is a completely breaking story. There's been conflict going on there. There's been a siege by the ISIS forces for the past several days. But Syrian troops have withdrawn, and my understanding is they've withdrawn from the urban areas, and they're gathering along with civilians, and they are still protecting the heritage site, which is incredible. If people just look online at Palmyra, P-A-L-M-Y-R-A, they can see the Roman ruins and treasures. This is an area that goes back 2,000 years before Christ, and it was under various empires' control at different points in history, but it's just an amazing archaeological site. And as we know, ISIS has a pattern, as they did in Iraq, of destroying archaeological treasures because of their fanatical religious faith. So this is one thing that's up right now. And the other thing that I'm going to be writing on in coming days, but this has not been widely broadcast yet, but just in the last couple of days, we have had, as a result of the Benghazi hearings that are taking place in the U.S. Congress, there have been Freedom of Information Act. There was a Freedom of Information Act request and lawsuit, and it's resulted in the release of documents from the the Defense Information Agency. So that's not the CIA, that's the DIA, which is the Department of Defense's intelligence agency, where in almost 3 years ago, in August of 2012, they described the general situation in Syria as, I will read you just a few lines from this, and then we'll talk about how it contrasts with the portrayal of the conflict that we hear from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and so many other groups. They describe it, and this is a direct quotation. Internally, events in Syria are taking a clear sectarian direction. The Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq are the major forces driving the insurgency in Syria. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has supported the Syrian opposition from the beginning. Al-Qaeda in Iraq considers the Sunni issue in Iraq to be faithfully connected to the Sunni Arabs and Muslims. We can talk about that, too, because it's got nothing to do with Sunni Muslim. It's Wahhabi and Salafi, which is a fanatical minority grouping. It goes on to say that after the rise of the insurgency in Syria, the religious and tribal powers in the regions began to sympathize with the sectarian uprising. And they give some details on that. And they give some predictions for the future. Now, I'm reading from a document that was a secret document that's been, that was released after a lawsuit. And they predict the regime will survive, that they're referring to the Damascus government, the regime will survive and have control over Syrian territory. On the other hand, opposition forces are trying to control the eastern areas, Hasaka and Deir ez-Zor, adjacent to the western Iraqi provinces, Mosul and Anbar, in addition to neighboring Turkish borders. Western countries, the Gulf states, and Turkey are supporting these efforts. And then they go on to say that If the situation unravels, there's the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria. So I won't read any more right now, but this needs to be broadcast much more, because 3 years ago, basically what this is proving, 3 years ago, the intelligence agencies of the U.S. knew that it was a sectarian uprising in Syria. All of this talk about peaceful, freedom-loving, democracy-loving protesters was nonsense. It was sectarian with the Muslim Brotherhood and Salafi forces. It was connected with Al-Qaeda, and they even predicted, before it happened, the establishment of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria. So this is precisely the area we're talking about with Palmyra.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of stopping, instead of taking that intelligence and saying, well, what are we doing aligning ourselves with Al-Qaeda in Iraq and religious fanatics, the U.S. has continued to destabilize and attack the Syrian government in cahoots with Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And here today you have the UNESCO World Heritage Site, Palmyra, at risk.
Well, you know, these, you know, thousands of years old monuments, various shrines and temples to various religions all survived in Syria for a long time. They survived colonialism, the current government, but now, in the last few years, great devastation has been done by sectarian forces. And it was the modus operandi of a number of opposition groups to be dynamiting anything that they saw as heathen, and that was well before the current year and well before ISIS formed as an official entity. And I think, you know, it very much gels with what you've been saying, that the United States and pretty much any government with the resources to investigate this conflict knew that the uprising in Syria in 2012 was sectarian, and that was of a sectarian character. And you point out the discord here, because I remember the coverage in our newspaper and television from 2012 and that period, in which, you know, it was a bunch of, we were given this cheery image of, these cuddly rebels who want just American pie freedom and we should love these guys and people that went over from Canada and the United States and Britain went over there to, as they put it, fight Assad, were celebrated. And they got newspaper article coverage and stories and said, this guy, he came, you know, he's from this town in Hamilton or, you know, in Canada or in Ontario or in you know, United States. Look at, they've gone to get rid of this evil dictatorship. And it was celebrated in our English-speaking media. You know, now it's becoming apparent that the nature of this military opposition was extremely sectarian. And this whole time, it's been transiting through Turkey. It's been funded by countries like Saudi Arabia. The United States has openly admitted and discussing training and or equipping these groups at various times. And this is a situation that we're left with now, unfortunately. You know, you could turn off the tap here and say, we're not going to send insurgents into Syria. We're not going to give them night vision goggles. We're not going to let Israel give them medical aid. We're not going to let Saudi Arabia give them money. We're not going to let them cross the Turkish border. We're not going to let people buy oil from ISIS. But all of these things continue to happen. And a lot of it is because of the transgressions against international law. It's not legal to send fighters into another country, even if they're vetted. And I understand Amnesty International said it was okay to vet insurgents, so you can make an approved list of fighters to send into Syria. That was in your article.
Exactly, Brendan. One of their proposals, in fact, to the international community was that if you're considering supplying arms to non-state armed groups, first carry out a rigorous human rights risk assessment. Unbelievable. I think an appropriate question would be, how would Americans feel if you had hundreds of thousands of heavily armed insurgents pouring into the U.S. from Canada and Mexico? And you had the insurgents being trained in Canada. You had the insurgents being supplied with anti-tank howitzers. You had tanks. The so-called rebels are operating tanks. They've got anti-tank weaponry. They've been supplied with the most sophisticated TOW, so-called TOW, anti-tank missiles.
Well, Rick, I've seen the same videos you have. They're on YouTube and LiveLeak and goodness knows where else, and they have the U.S.-made guided trailing optical wire missiles being given to what they call Syrian rebels, who aren't from Syria for the most part. And, they demonstrate these rebels being trained and using them against practice targets, and now we're seeing them appear in Syria. So, you know, how do U.S.-made guided rocket launchers end up in the hands of these people? Well, we have, you know, they can't help but post videos of that. So there are ways that this conflict could be turned down, but that doesn't seem to be what the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and a number of other countries, including Canada, want. So that's why you need to continue with your vigilance, and we need to ask, who do these human rights organizations serve, you know, and whose interest do they operate? What exactly do they want for Syria? You know, I guess you'll be doing more work on that. We can find your article in Counterpunch. It's called 8 Problems with Amnesty's Report on Aleppo, Syria, and it's in a variety of other publications as well. And it follows in a series of similar such articles that were present in the prior months and weeks. So people can Google that. You can Google Rick Sterling's name, as he said, which is spelt Sterling, Sterling, to get further information on that. So, Rick, I wanted to thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Okay. Thank you, Brendan. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Rick. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Rick Sterling, and I should just mention, you can find that article on Counterpunch, 8 Problems with Amnesty's Report on Aleppo, Syria. That's from May 14, and you can get similar articles about Human Rights Watch and other related issues in prior weeks in Counterpunch and all over the internet if you just use a search engine. I found an interesting website or blog to follow on this is Interventions Watch. Just look that up, Intervention Watch. They looked at the incident with Human Rights Watch and Ken Roth's story about what he called Assad's barrel bombs in Aleppo, which turned out to be Gaza, Israel's bombs on Gaza. So check that out if you get a chance. And that's it for this week. Until next time, take care.